Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Let's Talk Learning Spaces. I'm your host, Forrest Foster, Head of Information Commons Access Services here at Winston-Salem State University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And we're back again. It's been a while. Sorry to keep people holding. A lot of things are going on here, and we'll get into that in a few seconds. But today we have a special guest, Alexandra Mitchell, who is a reference librarian and archivist at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, Manuscripts, Archives, and Rare Books Division at the New York Public Library in New York. Glad to have you on the show. Thank you for coming
on
the show.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Forrest.
Cool,
this is a pleasure.
No problem. No problem. I just want to touch on some housekeeping things right quick. I know a lot of people were wondering, locally probably and within the state, that we do have a new dean now, and she will be coming March 6th, I think, 6th or 7th, whatever that Monday is. I want to say it's the 7th, second week in March, and it is Wanda Brown, former associate director from Wake Forest University. So, thank you. I just want to send that out to the people who are avid listeners. You know, some people were wondering who that was since it had been posted for a while, and we finally got an individual, and I think she's going to be an awesome fit. Also, too, there are some positions still out there, some librarian positions out there. They probably are still on hold because of that dean decision or director's decision. So the dean will be coming in March, and then I'm pretty sure she's going to actually start up looking and assessing and posting those positions again. So that's just a little info for people who are wondering about those positions. And then, of course, we had a little snow, too, so everybody's griping and complaining and getting into work a little late. But, yeah, a little snow won't hurt, you know, get a couple hours off from work and get started. But today's show is about, I guess, we can tie it into, I guess, crowdsourcing a cultural heritage. And our guest today, I'm going to let her talk about some of her history and how she got into librarianship and give a little bit of background about yourself, if you don't mind.
No problem. Alrighty. So my journey into the library and archives world began during my undergraduate studies. I am a Bison, proud Bison. I attended Howard University. During my time at Howard University, I worked with the South African Research and Archival Project, which was a group of faculty members and graduate students from the history department at Howard that were putting together a number of online resources for researchers who wanted to focus specifically on South Africa. I worked in the Moreland Spingarn Research Center looking at the Max Juergen papers and created an online online reference and research guide for the Max Juergen papers, specifically related to his work with the Council on African Affairs and Paul Robeson and the work that he did related to South Africa. During my time at Moreland Spingarn, I was really enjoying working with the resources and talking with the archivists and librarians there. They were extremely helpful. And the following summer 2009, I participated in the Schomburg Mellon Summer Humanities Institute here at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. That program is geared towards undergraduates who want to go to graduate school in the humanities, namely focusing on African diaspora, history related to Africa or the continent or the Caribbean or African-American studies. It was during that time that I realized that I really enjoyed working with the materials as a scholar, but I really enjoy working more closely with them as on the other side from the library and archives perspective on a more intimate level, not only engaging them as a scholar. So I ended up speaking with that at that time, Diana LaChatelier was the curator of the Manuscript Archive and Rare Books Division here at the Schomburg Center. And also my current supervisor and boss, who's amazing, Stephen G. Fullwood, who's the associate curator of the division now. Just in terms of, you know, what do I need to do in terms of schooling? What does the career trajectory look like? What is the path that, you know, leads you to become a librarian and or archivist? After I completed undergrad, I actually took some time off before going to graduate school. I moved to Dakar, Senegal for a year-long teaching fellowship at the Senegalese American Bilingual School in Dakar. And then I came back and I began graduate school at New York University, where I completed a dual master's in library science via Long Island University. And I did a second master's in Africana studies at NYU. It was a lot of fun. It was a great program. I finished in 2013. And during my first year of graduate school, Sylvian Duf, who was the director of the Lapita Center for the Historical Analysis of Transatlantic Slavery, and also the head of digital collections here at the Schomburg, hired me as her research assistant. So I've kind of been around here for a while, on and off, right, in a few different projects. And then the job now presented itself more recently, and I've been here for about almost six months now. So it's kind of a full circle moment for me being back here at the Schomburg Center. And that's how I've become a librarian archivist. And it's been a really blessed path for me. So I've enjoyed it.
We have a committee here that kind of, you know, we look for new things, and some old, some new, some hot, some, you know, what's going to be the future. Some people out there doing engaging things. And we saw you on, correct me if I'm wrong, but the GSAS thesis. Is that correct? It's a little video. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And I'm sorry I didn't know much more about it, but I remember the name, I think, if I said it right.
Yes,
can
that's
you tell
correct.
Us a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So GSAS thesis is through the New York University's Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. It's a competition they started a few years ago for the students from the master's college there that challenges the students to put their graduate thesis or research, whatever research topics they're working on, into non-discipline-specific language, and to present that in front of a crowd of your peers. And also there's a jury of judges, different deans from the university, and professors across disciplines in 3 minutes or less. And it needs to be engaging. You have one PowerPoint slide behind you, and you have 3 minutes to get your point across, which may sound easy on the outskirts, but once you sit down, you're in your field, you're in your Africana, you use the word African diaspora 30 times a day, you use, you know, theory words a billion times a day, and they just become second nature to you. But when you're trying to explain that to a physicist or a biology major or somebody who's never heard of the African diaspora before, it becomes a little more difficult. So I was able to participate in the thesis. I had really big support from my professors at New York University. I presented my thesis, which looked at the Afro-Cuban diaspora here in New York City and in Cuba. I mainly focused on Chano Pozo, who was an Afro-Cuban percussionist who played for Dizzy Gillespie during the Cubop and Bebop era here in New York City during the 40s and 50s. And they created Dizzy Gillespie's most popular tune, one of his most popular tunes, Manteca, which was originally created by Chano Pozo. So I presented that. I ended up winning that competition, which was in 2012 or 2013, I guess that was the spring of.
I think it was 2013.
2013, there we go. All the time is kind of running together at this point. But it was a really, really exciting thing to do. It really challenged me as a scholar to understand my own research. After working with it so much, you get used to your own work. You don't have to figure out how to explain it to other people, but that's the point, right? You want to engage other crowds. You want to be able to share your work across as many platforms as possible. So that was the thesis competition.
Yeah, and it was cool that somebody posted it because, you know, other than that, we wouldn't have known about it. And it just, you know, kind of shows you what everybody's always talking about, the, you know, advancement of technology and how you can reach people and see what people are doing and spreading info that way. So tell us a little bit about what you do on a daily basis with your job today. I know it's, you know, you're kind of like a reference/archivist and you do a couple of things, but, you know, and tie that into crowdsourcing and what is crowdsourcing?
Absolutely. So here at the Schomburg Center, I've been 4 out of 5 days of the week in the Manuscript Archive and Rare Books Division, where I do a number of different activities. There's always something changing and fast-paced going on here, so it switches from day to day. But consistently, I spend about 80% of my time performing reference services and about 20% of my time performing my archivist and processing and accessioning responsibilities, and I say about 25% of my other 100% of my time doing a number of other projects that pop up over time. But I'm on the reference desk. I'm doing virtual reference via email or over the phone. I'm processing a number of collections, including the Shirl Boyce Taylor papers. She was the mother of Fife Dog, the leader of A Tribe Called Quest.
Oh, really?
Mary Helen. Yes. So his mother's a poet. She's a really, really interesting woman. We have her papers here. She's a fascinating, fascinating figure.
Okay.
Originally from Trinidad and migrated here to New York City during her teenage years. So it kind of tracks her personal history, her work as a poet and artist here in New York City. The Mary Helen Washington papers. Mary Helen Washington is a scholar at the University of Maryland who focuses on the left, labor in the left, and black women writers and communists. Also processed a number of smaller collections, such as the Rep Club, which is a facility or organization of black men, all male society here in New York that get together, social club, as well as the Donald Washington papers, who is a dancer and activist here in the States, who's really thriving in the black dance world. So working with a number of really exciting collections, assisting with new acquisitions, bringing new collections in, trying to figure out what's important to our researchers here and how can I assist with that. We do a number of class visits. So we have students from fourth grade through university students to graduate students who want to come in and learn more about our materials here and how they can use them in their own research. And I do a number of pop-up exhibits. I did some really exciting pop-up exhibits for, we have the First Fridays here at the Schomburg Center. I did one for our Michael Jackson versus Prince exhibit, which was a lot of fun. And I also did one for our, this is the 90th year of the Schomburg Center. And so I did one for our 90th anniversary party, which was a lot of fun.
What was the Michael Jackson versus Prince? That sounds interesting. What was that about?
So Michael Jackson versus Prince was the theme for our, I guess it was the November First Fridays. And so it was actually just two pop-up cases here in our lobby for visitors to see what materials that we have related to Prince and Michael Jackson. We have a really, really strong collection of materials from The Wiz, for Michael Jackson's participation in The Wiz and press coverage and him and Diana Ross and the other members of the cast. And so it was really cool to look through those older materials and to piece them together. We have a number of monographs written about Prince and his life and his work with some really interesting covers. Of course, our Photographs and Prince division is very, very strong with collections that pertain to both Prince and Michael Jackson. So aesthetically, it was one of my most exciting projects to work on here in terms of the pop-up exhibitions. And they're just two really fun figures to look at. In general, they're really fascinating figures in terms of black music and culture. And I'm a really, really big Prince and Michael Jackson fan. So it was a little bit of business mixed with pleasure for me. And so those are just some of the exciting things that go on here in terms of that. I'm also in the Jean Blackwell Hudson Research and Reference Division once a week. And so we have a number of researchers that come in from students just doing homework to elders in the community who need assistance with whatever projects they're working on. I also do a number of prison letters. We have a prison outreach service that we provide reference sources and materials to inmates for research materials and books that they're interested in. So there's always something going on, and it's exciting.
Yeah, I see. Might be reaching up there about some resources and some collections up there.
Please do.
Sound like y'all have
plenty
a
whatever.
Right. So tell us a little bit about the crowdsourcing and from your aspect and how, you've been in the field for a couple of years, but you've been doing some things throughout those years and beyond those first, I guess, 2 or 3 years. Tell a little bit about crowdsourcing and how has it, kind of benefited your library or libraries or museums that you've been at.
Excellent. So, overall crowdsourcing is, gathering information and resources by a group of individuals traditionally out, not inside of the institution that's gathering those materials.
Right.
So over the years, in my personal interest in archives and in the library world, I've been looking, you know, at a few examples of this and how can I build something larger out of it. In the spring of 2015, I presented at the Black Portraiture Conference in Florence, Italy, which was a conference put together by NYU, the Studio Museum of Harlem, Harvard, and a number of other institutions. And the presentation, which was entitled Encountering the Archives, Restaging Histories of Black Radical Spaces, looked at non-traditional sources of collecting for memory and meaning making. So I initially pulled from our library foremothers and archival foremothers, Dorothy Porter Wesley from Howard University and Jean Blackwell Hudson, who was here at the Schomburg Center. And I paired that with theory that was presented by Robin D.G. Kelly, who's a scholar at UCLA, in his work Freedom Dreams, the Black Radical Imagination. And okay. Freedom Dreams, Robin Kelly proposes this idea of a freedom space. And his idea of a freedom space looks at the ways in which a society can be recreated that reshapes the desires and dreams of the participants, and it kind of, it makes the space for the people, right? And so I'm thinking about right. the archive as this traditional space, and, you know, being at a university or being at a more higher education university, or, you know, a space that's not necessarily inclusive of the everyday common person, how can we transition those spaces or transition these resources and make it more inclusive? So I looked at that. I looked at the Robin Kelly idea in theory. I also looked at Fred Cedric Robinson's Black Radical Tradition framework, proposed in his 2007 text, Forgeries of Memory and Meaning Making, to draw on radical aesthetic traditions, namely the extension of his Regime of Truth idea. And I looked at Black radical archival practices of memory and meaning making through creativity in the jazz aesthetic with people like Louis Armstrong, who we know has the amazing Louis Armstrong Museum in Corona, Queens here, which was originally his house. It's a historical house museum. It was his house. Louis Armstrong, among being a preeminent musician, was also an archivist, what Robert O'Mealy would call an auto-archivist. He literally saved everything he did. So if it was an interview, if it was a photograph, if it was a note card,
That sounds like me.
It sounds like a lot of people we know in our field, yeah. right? So Louis Armstrong was kind of a pioneer in what he was doing, especially not having received any formal training. So I wanted to look at how people were preserving memory and meaning-making in our field and in the Black world, outside of the academy, outside of traditional institutions, and how crowdsourcing kind of leads towards that that idea and that notion and what people are doing now. So a number of the projects I looked at in terms of that, I looked at Instagram. There are a number of current Instagram pages that really are pushing the boundary in terms of crowdsourcing and letting people submit to them. Those platforms include Save Family Photos. Save Family Photos has a website and an Instagram. Anybody can submit. Typically, people post a photograph of a family member, a grandmother, grandfather, aunt, uncle, you know, brother, mother, and they give a lengthy caption that includes the history of the photograph, what this means to them and their family, why this is important.
Right.
I also looked at Albie Square 87, which is a hip-hop Instagram archive, started by a guy named Q Douglas, who is Brooklyn-based, and which kind of talked to him recently about some other things, but he explained to me that it initially started out just some photographs that he had from growing up, and Albee Square was a mall that was very popular in Brooklyn during the 80s where a lot of the original hip-hop figures hung out, including, you know, Biz Markie, LL Cool J. They all frequented this space, and it became a really, really sacred space in terms of the hip-hop world in New York, and so he's gathered a large audience, and the people are really interested in what he's displaying on his Instagram and recreating these narratives and recreating these stories. And so Nas has been really supportive of him. The Fader and Complex Magazine both covered his Instagram, so I kind of looked at him and what he's doing there. And I also looked at the Caribbean Memory Project. The Caribbean Memory Project is based in Port of Spain, Trinidad. It was started by Dawn Cumberbatch and Kevin A. Brown. Dawn is a photographer and videographer, I believe, and Kevin A. Brown is a scholar. He's here in New York. I believe he was at Buffalo. I'm not sure where he is now, but they're doing some really, really exciting things with the Caribbean Memory Project. They do a number of oral history programs so people can come and tell a story. They have a website online where you can submit to them and tell a story. They do a mobile archiving service, which they call MASS. We know Carnival was just last week, so it's kind of framed in that, you know, that MASS trajectory, right, of the excitement, right, and, you know, letting loose of that tradition. But they essentially, their program goes around and collects resources and materials from people's homes. They scan them for them. They archive them for them. Often they let people keep the materials. They don't necessarily take them from the home if the person's not comfortable with that. But they make it available on a digital platform, which is their website. People can submit and also look at the resources there. So I was looking at all these examples and how they kind of tie into ideas of crowdsourcing and kind of pushing us outside of the traditional institution as we want to build and kind of engage different audiences and crowds, and how can we be more inclusive. So that's kind of how I got into crowdsourcing and some of the things I've been working on prior to being here now.
So I guess, you know, when you go out and you're speaking about crowdsourcing or mobile archiving and you're promoting it, this is what you do, this is your profession. You know, there's those individuals in the profession and some outside the profession that are always going to ask about the validity and authenticity of people implementing their thoughts and information into crowdsourcing.
Right.
What do you say to those individuals, those attractors who, you know, speak about maybe not having that validity or having the understanding and the full scope of crowdsourcing, or, you know, the implement to the standards of crowdsourcing?
Right. So, I mean, I think there's pros and cons to looking at both perspectives, especially understanding the importance of preservation and conservation and security in the archive, and being able to maintain collections over time, and making sure people are able to access collections over time. I think that there's, you know, that can't be underscored enough in terms of importance. But I stand more in supporting of, you know, ideas like what the Caribbean Memory Project or, you know, what they're doing in terms of their mobile archiving service, because it's engaging that different audience. It's engaging that different crowd, and it's for the everyday person. And I come from the academy. I'm a scholar. You know, I'm an archivist, and, you know, I have the traditional path in a lot of my training and upbringing, but I'm really interested in working outside of that space on a consistent basis. And so I kind of push back on that a little bit, and I encourage people to step out of those traditional comforts and bounds by engaging the everyday common person in their work. And so I totally support what people are doing with the mobile archiving service with Caribbean Memory Project and Instagram and, you know, other websites and other programs that people are doing. I think they're innovative. I think they're exciting. I think they're important. I think there's a space for that. I think there's a very important space for that because, I mean, the everyday person won't be able to make it to the Schomburg Center to submit their papers, but that doesn't make their story any less important or any less important to the narrative of Black people in the diaspora. So I say if you're interested in being, you know, exclusive or, you know, hierarchical in your approach, then, you know, by all means, you know, stay in that space. But if you're interested in engaging and being more inclusive and open and flexible, then I would definitely encourage people to look towards that mobile archiving example.
Now, you got some cool projects going on. There are a couple of things, but we only have about 6 minutes left, so I really want to get into
this. Oh, wow.
Just,
okay.
Yeah, see?
Wow, it goes like that.
Just
okay.
Talk about your projects. You know, I've been looking at them, but, you know, you tell it. You have your own story, and you tell your story in your own unique way. So I just want them to hear a couple of your projects that you're working on.
Okay, well, that went by really quickly, number one. Number
right.
two, in terms of the projects that are currently going on, I'm working on my first co-authored monograph with a brilliant scholar, Megan Goins-Duff, who is a fellow Howard University graduate, excuse me. And she also completed the same dual master's program that I did at New York University.
Okay.
The title of the monograph is Research Strategies and Techniques for the Study of Black Writing. That's forthcoming under Roman and Littlefield, the publishing house. Prayerfully this year we'll be complete with it and done with it, and I'll be able to release it and move forward. That's a really exciting project that's been ongoing. Also, I just released a new podcast series here at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. The name of the podcast series is Live from the Reading Room Correspondence. Right. Every week there's a letter featured from collections here in the Manuscript Archive and Rare Books Division, written by or to key figures from the African diaspora. So
now, let me ask you something right quick. I'm sorry, let me interject something. How do you, and I know I'm just jumping in, but we don't have too much time,
please,
but how do you assess who's watching or who's listening? Do you have any type of format or as of yet?
The podcast is shared across platforms. So we have our Tumblr, we have our Facebook, we have there's one I'm forgetting at the moment, excuse me. But so I can see the number of people who've listened. I can from our SoundCloud page, I can see, you know, who's listened, I can see who's commented on things, I can see who's liked things. I can't get more specific than that, and I've tried not to. I try to avoid comments as much as possible, to be honest. But you know, we can definitely track the numbers of listeners and who's sharing and you know, kind of how it's being circulated through the world. And you know, you see things pop up in your own social networks after people post them elsewhere. So it kind of comes back eventually. You see how it's kind of being shared across. Mm-hmm.
Right. So with the podcast, what do you see happening? What do you want to do with the future of that? Are you just taking baby steps, or do you have a long-term vision in mind, or are you just going with the flow?
Well, we have a vision in mind. Initially, we're doing a weekly, monthly rollout for now. For the first month of February, we started with a letter from Arthur Schomburg to Langston Hughes. That was followed up last Friday by a letter from Aaron Douglas to his wife, a love letter. There'll be two more love letters for the rest of this month. And then moving forward, every month from now on will be a biweekly post. On Fridays, we're going to continue with the Friday trajectory. And each month we'll tap into whatever is, you know, the more important topic for that month. So March will focus on women because it's Women's History Month. And so moving forward, we'll just engage those kind of what's going on in the world. You know, there's a traditional something being celebrated, or if there's a popular topic or something political or something important that comes up. And then we have something that touches on here in our collections. We want to make sure that we're engaging what's relevant. That's what's most important.
Right.
We're engaging what's most relevant and what kind of shows our crown jewels here at the Schomburg Center.
Right. And just for the individuals that are listening or watching, there are some photos up. I think one of them is the Aaron Douglas letter, if I'm not mistaken. I can't see it now because I don't have it.
Yes, one of them is the Aaron Douglas letter, yes.
I think, and if I'm not mistaken, there is it might be a Langston Hughes picture in regards to, I guess, one of his letters, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And there are a few more. I can't remember the order I put them in, but they are rotating on the podcast homepage. So just take a look at those for those that are listening in or watching. Is there anything else you want to share in regards to your work or what's going on up in Harlem?
Up in Harlem, there's a lot going on in Harlem. It's always exciting here. There's a number of interesting and exciting programs here at the Schomburg Center. My colleagues are always doing fun and innovative things. We have the Green Books, which are available now. There's a lot of really big coverage on that, so I encourage people to look to the Green Books for resources and materials. We have a number of online exhibitions, which are always available remotely if you're not able to make it into the Schomburg Center, so I encourage you to view those. Also, our consistent blog posts and materials, and you can always follow us on our Facebook and our Tumblr and our Instagram. So please engage us and chime in. And I'm available on Twitter and on Instagram at Queen of the Stacks. Forrest, thank you for having me today. I really enjoyed this. It went by really quickly.
It did, didn't it? Real quick.
It went by extremely quickly. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's been a pleasure.
No problem. You know, we tried to, you know, as I said before, see what's out there, see who's doing some innovative things, and trying to bring them on the show just to share some of their learning spaces and how they tie into their maybe local community and how that's maybe being broadcasted globally, how you're, you know, reaching out beyond the community. So a lot of people are doing a lot of great things, and we just wanted to recognize some people and, you know, just shed the light, because that's we have a medium to do that, so that's why we're doing it. I just want to thank everybody who listened in. Next month or next couple of weeks, we're going to have a couple individuals in. I'm not sure yet because we haven't officially tab them yet, but we have some people in mind. And it's probably the topic will probably be about maker spacers, and the one after that might be another surprise. So thank you for tuning in. I greatly appreciate it as always, and talk to you next time. Thank you very much.
All righty.